From their studio in the Feeding Arizona building in Youngtown, Arizona, it's the Boomer and the Babe Show with Pete Peters and Deborah Brown. Join Pete and Deborah and their guests as they give voice to 78 million baby boomers from coast to coast and border to border. Now here are the Boomer and the Babe, Pete Peters and Deborah Brown.
And yes, indeed. Welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show. It is 11 o'clock in Phoenix, Arizona, 1 o'clock on the East Coast, and 10 o'clock on the West. And we trust that everybody's having a good day so far. I don't think there's too much weather beating up too many people, so that's a good sign. I know we're looking for about 78 degrees here in Phoenix. Oh, I wasn't going to say that to anybody because I've been told that we have enough people in Phoenix as it is, so we don't want to attract too many people. I'm just joking on that. Come on down. Everybody come down to Phoenix. Bring your money, bring your wallets, and let's make some jobs happen down here, and we're going to be one of the states that comes back strong. That having been said, my political statement being over, I want to remind everybody that the Boomer and the Babe does more than just this radio show. We also have a website, and we also publish ebooks and mini books. You can go to BoomerandTheBabe.com, see everything else that we're involved in. That website is in a state of flux right now. There's some new things that we're going to be adding, so we want to remind you that come back frequently, because we will, after all, be changing it as we go. We also have several other shows. We have a show called Wealth DNA with Ron Naraki on our network here on Blog Talk. He talks about finances and things financial. We also have a show that we did this morning called Straight Down the Middle. It's our golf show. We had an interesting conversation today with a woman by the name of Nancy Collins, she's the founder and developer of something called Sassy Golf, which is golf for women. You get a chance to listen to that show on this Blog Talk location as well. Please do that, especially if you're a lady, you're interested in golf, and if you're interested in possibly being in the golf business. Sassy Golf might be something for you to take a look at, and Nancy would be an interesting person to talk to. I'm Pete Peters. Deborah's not here today. She's under the weather. She's going to be doing a reading project for our granddaughter tomorrow morning early at her school. She's going to be reading Dr. Seuss books to the kids, the seventh graders, or the 7-year-olds in the first and second grades. And she's trying to make sure that she maintains her health to the degree that she's not going to be too contagious tomorrow, and that she's going to have a voice, because her voice is gone as we speak. All that having been said, hope you endured my commercialism for the moment. We want to introduce our guest right now. Our guest's name is Jill Titelman. Jill is the author of a book called Saving Gracie. I think it's a cross between a novel and a memoir. We're going to discuss when one becomes the other and clones over to the other. And I just want to welcome her to the show. Jill, welcome to the Boomer and the Babe Show.
Thanks so much. Great to be there.
Well, we're glad to have you here, believe me. If Deborah were here, Jill, she would ask you for your 2-minute movie. By that, she would mean who and where is Jill Titelman, and when did she, and where did she come from, and what she'd been doing prior to being the author of Saving Gracie. So, just a little background on your history, if you don't mind.
Oh, that'd be great. Well, let's see. I have been a writer probably ever since I learned how to make a letter. But taught writing for many, many years. I was a college writing, creative writing teacher mostly, and I also worked in television. I worked in public affairs programs and did some radio work, and would go back and forth to teaching, and then decided, okay, this is the time of my life when if I am a writer, I better really get my own book out there. I had published a lot of things, but never my own book. This is a story that's very autobiographical. And it's about a friendship between two mothers in Boston, two older mothers, actually, who are very, very different. And they go through all kinds of wonderful and terrible things together, each in their own lives. One of them is married. One of them is sometimes married, sometimes single in the book. And people say that it makes them laugh and it makes them cry, but that they end up laughing. so it feels great to finally have my story out there. It's, as you said, it's called Saving Gracie, and it is quite a bit true. It's it is fiction because I've changed some things, but most people, I think, will read it as if everything happened in it, I hope. Mm-hmm. So that's a little bit about my story.
Well, it's when I get these books from the publicists and so on, they, many of them, and I'm sure you know that yours, Meryl Moss, sends along a one page bio almost, or synopsis, and it's interesting that we could jump right into this, I guess. The headline on this page that they sent me is Sex and the Single Baby Boomer. And,
mm-hmm.
and it says, you're over 50, you're single, and you're still searching for Mr. Right. Is it safe to say that that is the crux of this book?
Well, you know, the book is an earlier version of my life. The book, it takes place when the main character, whose name is Ruth, not Jill, but Ruth, is just about to turn 40. And I'm older than that now, and a lot has happened. So my life now, I would say, at some points in the book I'm dating, actually. Some points in the book I have a partner, and I'm about to have a baby with that partner that I should say, Ruth, hasn't married. Then along comes someone else that she separates from him, and then she has a late in life marriage, and then an even later in life divorce. For myself, that is true. And but the dating, you know, 10 years down the road, 15 years down the road, the dating rules change, and everything is so different now, dating now. So, you know, for instance, the way the two people meet in the book, she actually meets the husband through a person, but it's a personal ad in a magazine. Well, you know, no one does that anymore. You used to have to write a letter to somebody and put a stamp on it and say, I read your ad in the magazine. Would you like to correspond with me? Or, you know, or you would give them your phone number. It seems like prehistory, doesn't it?
Oh, that's when guys were walking around with a club, beat the woman over the head with a club, and drag them off to the grave by the hair.
Pretty much. Or women doing the same.
Yeah, exactly.
So you know, you're older, you've had, you know, some experiences in between. You maybe get more and more sure of what you want, and you maybe get more and more sure you won't get it, because it does become harder as you get older. It seems like in our 20s, in my 20s, it was all I had to do was sort of leave my apartment and I would meet somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't happen so much to women over 50 and over 60. So, or men.
Well, do you think it was for a woman of your age currently, do you think it was different today for a woman of your age than it was back when you were 20, there were women of your age? Do you think women of your age that were single at that time were facing the same thing then that you might be facing now?
Oh, no. I think it was so completely different. I mean, by the time, I mean, I'm over 60, and I will tell you that. I won't tell you how much older, but I will tell you I've hit 60. And you're nice enough not to ask. And it's completely different. I mean, women of that age, and they were either already divorced or widows, which a lot of women are today, of course. But, you know, the idea of still hoping to have a romance after your kids have grown and gone off on their own, for a woman of that generation to have a romance, I think, it happened. But you get a lot of these family stories. There was always one crazy uncle or one crazy aunt who was still dating, you know, but everyone would consider them kind of eccentric or weird.
Mm-hmm.
I think people just...
I had an aunt like that, as a matter of fact.
You did?
Yeah, I'm
so
serious.
What happened to her? Maybe you should tell me.
I'm very serious. I mean, she was my grandmother's sister, actually my mother's aunt, and she was single and traveling and dating men and whatever after her husband had died.
Uh-huh.
And she never remarried. She lived to be a ripe old age, and she, I think, died of, as best I can tell, a happy woman.
Wow.
So, and I, that's I mean, when you mentioned that, it just all brought it back to me in a flash. But
yeah.
I'll be darned. That was
yeah.
That's Aunt Ingrid.
She was ahead of her time.
She was. She was absolutely ahead of her time.
Yeah, yeah. It's, you know, I think that those of us who are, you know, not single, I mean, those of us who are single, you know, by choice, because, I mean, you can always find somebody.
Yeah.
I mean, if I wanted to be just with somebody or married or, you know, even have a steady boyfriend, I could probably, you know, have one, but it's...
You could make that happen.
Yeah, but you can't, I mean, there are a lot of men out there. I think there are lots and lots of men, but I think that, and for men, there are lots of women, too, of course. Probably, you know, everyone says there are more men, more women than for men than there are men for women. I mean, those are the statistics. But I really think that if you'd rather be by yourself and live a great life by yourself than be with somebody else and have your life diminished too much, then why would you do it?
Right, right.
Why wouldn't you want to live what life to your fullest potential? And it's a compromise. It's a compromise either way. You know, life isn't perfect. Sure,
oh,
wish it were.
Oh, that it make life interesting. It make life make life easier, but it certainly would be less interesting.
Yeah.
You know what? You know the old story about that's what makes the world go round. You know.
I think if you know kids that are in their 20s today and thinking about getting married, I think a lot of them kind of have seen their parents divorce and maybe more than once and have a lot of you know changes in their lives because of different partners. And I think a lot of these kids I know, including my son, they really are more focused. I think they think, okay, this is important. I'm going to find the right person. It may take me a while, but I'm not going to just jump into this. But I definitely want to be in a relationship because it's for a large part it's a nicer way to live if you're taking care of somebody and they're taking care of you. It's nice. It's very nice.
Well,
but,
it is. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think that it's so hard to make that decision. But I think it kind of makes itself. You don't really make it. It's kind of what happens to you in life, right? Some people just happen to go from relationship to relationship. And some people really, I'm one of those people. I've had many, I'm old enough to have had many, and still have spent a lot of time alone.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, big gaps between relationships, for instance.
Well, it's possible. And, it's possible that you could be married to somebody, be living with them, and still be alone.
Well, isn't that worse, though?
Well, I'm suggesting it may well be, but you know,
yeah.
the fact is that you can still be alone even though you're married. You can still be very much alone, and that's so. Either are you better off being married and alone, or are you better just living by yourself and having it the way you want to have it?
Yeah. Well, then there's, I guess, a lot of relationships outside of marriages too that happen. Judging from the personal ads that I read, there are, you know, so many people that are very, very candid, many, 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 about I'm married, but I need some fun.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just out there. It's just absolutely, you know, amazing to me. Well, why don't you just get divorced, you know? Mm-hmm. What is it that's so... But again, you know, that's their lives. I don't know. I mean, I wouldn't judge anybody. I wouldn't want to be involved with anybody like that, on the other hand.
Well, yeah, that's true. I mean,
I wouldn't. You know, I just wouldn't want to do that.
To each his or her own.
Yeah.
You know, and as long as I'm not involved in that kind of a tryst, it's fine with me. I don't care what you're doing.
Well, you probably know men who are. You probably talk to them on the golf course about it.
I have. Known men.
He's not going to admit it, of course, but you probably do.
No. I have.
Or women.
I have known men and women that are.
I hear stories.
Or have been.
Yeah.
I bet you do.
I hear a lot of stories.
Yeah.
I taught writing for a lot of years, and women. I taught at a women's college actually in Boston. Simmons College, and had a lot of older women students who came back to get degrees, and Oh my goodness, they had from all over the world, and they had so many stories about different versions of marriage. It's pretty fascinating.
Well, and you can just look around. You can see there's all kinds of interpretation of the word marriage, and how people live in a marriage. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing.
What percentage? I mean, do you know what percentage of your listeners are actually single?
You know, I don't have that information.
We'll have to figure that out another time.
Yeah, we will. I mean, I've tried to get some of that demographic information from the people that keep the stats at Blog Talk.
Don't you think there are different interests? I think for, you know, people who are single are, they kind of have an opposite life of people who are you know, in couples, because when you're single, you often have your career and your work and your Monday to Friday kind of figured out. But when it comes to taking vacations and weekends and even evenings company, it seems like people who are settled down with someone, you know, pretty much need their time to kind of chill out and be together just in a, you know, at home doing whatever they do, just relaxing.
Decompress.
I thought you said being compressed. Being depressed. Decompressing.
Oh, yeah.
And giving time to each other. Our relationships take time.
Sure.
So, you know, I think singles, it's just such a different thing. I mean, you can't just assume. I mean, I go to movies by myself all the time. I do all sorts of things by myself. And I have many, many friends to do things with. But, you know, nonetheless, those birthdays and Valentine's days and all these things keep piling up, and when you're coupled up, they're just, you automatically have plans. You know, you have a date for your birthday when you have a partner, and if you don't have a partner, you don't know that you have a date for your birthday.
We did a show not that long ago with a woman who travels the world, and she is single, and she goes all over the world, and she has all these tremendous adventures that she undertakes. Some of them she's working as a volunteer in outer Slobovia, helping build a village or whatever the case might be. And she's doing it as a single woman. And she travels to France as a single woman. And she goes mountain climbing as a single woman. And she is living a life that is unbelievable. And she claimed to not have any desire whatsoever to be with a man or married. Not that she's living a homosexual lifestyle or anything. She just likes doing her thing because it's all hers, and she knows doggone good and well that she can do whatever she wants whenever she damn well pleases.
I can relate to that. I mean, that's one of the perks, is no one's going to tell you. You just do whatever you want all the time. If you want to, you know, have a certain kind of music playing that somebody else doesn't like, too bad. They're not there and you can do it.
She related the story that there were several people that are good friends, of very good friends of hers, and they have traveled in the past together, and that she wanted to have that. She found this adventure package or whatever it was, and she wanted to go, and she said, wouldn't it be great? Let's all go. And they said, no, I really don't want to. No, I don't care for it. She says, well, okay, I'm leaving on whatever date. And she went off by herself. She said, I wasn't going to let them hold me back from doing something that I want to do. She said, was it scary? She says, I was absolutely scared when I looked over that abyss, and I said, I got to climb down there. But she said, it was exhilarating. It was fun, and she has no regrets whatsoever.
I've done a lot of traveling by myself, and you meet so many interesting people when you're by yourself. You just do, because you have to. You know, there you are, and you really need to ask other people where, especially if you hear someone speaking English, if it's in another country. And you end up with these wonderful encounters with people that you go off and you share a taxi somewhere to do something, or you have a meal. And the people that you meet traveling who are alone are often, you know, very obviously self-sufficient, really interesting people who have a lot to share, a lot of amazing stories particularly. I was in Asia last spring for 5 weeks by myself. And, there were a few times when I was pretty scared. I was lost somewhere, and I didn't speak a word of, I was in Laos, I didn't speak any Laotian. And some guy came, I was really scared, it was getting dark, and some guy came by on a motorcycle, a very young guy, like a teenager, and he saw me there, and he said, you know, I told him where I was going, and he thought he knew where it was, and he said, well, let me give you a ride on my motorcycle. And I honestly, I thought, well, I might as well take this, because if I'm going to stand out in this dark street here with nobody around, that could be just as bad. And he took me where he thought I was supposed to be going, and of course it was the wrong place, but... So then I had to find my way back from there, but at least I got, you know, I closer to civilization, so I took a risk.
Sure.
So,
well, you know.
It's, you know.
But it's all risks, isn't it?
Yes. It's a risk to sit home and not have plans. You know, it's a risk. I have friends and relationships, and to me, you know, they just don't seem to go on vacation or do anything together, and I
mm-hmm.
think, gosh, what, you know, it's nice to be homey and cozy, and it's nice to water the lawn and mow the lawn once, you know, it's, but gosh, don't you guys want to, you know, and it's always, well, he wants to do this, but I don't really like it, and he doesn't want to do what I want to do, so they end up staying home. And I, just, and I think, well, go by yourself, come with me. It's the same exact thing.
Yeah.
But it's fun to, you know, it's nice to have a balance. I mean, the ideal thing would be to have, for me, a very a relationship with a lot of freedom in it. If you've had total freedom, I don't think you can ever give most of it up.
Right.
I could give a little bit of it up.
The right.
the character in my book, the book is Saving Gracie, and it's gotten, you know, great reviews, and I think a lot of people relate to this book because it's about a woman who always decided that she was going to be independent and never really tried to become traditional, married, et cetera. And then all of a sudden she's almost 40 and she starts to think, oh my God, you know, I'm not going to be able to have a kid. I'm not going to be able to do these things that I never really thought that much about. I better hurry up and think about doing them. And then she kind of upheaves her life. She changes her life completely and does have a child. Then ends up single again and goes through all kinds of stuff, but she's feisty. You know, she learns. She learns from her mistakes, and she becomes, I think, a very fun character to read about. She's very, very funny.
Well, I don't mean to get away from being funny, because I want to hear the funny parts of this book. Believe me, I do.
Yeah, there's lots of funny parts.
This has been brought to my attention by somebody close to me that has no children of their own. Both parents are deceased. Has sisters or brothers, but not particularly close, but close. You know what I'm saying? You kind of ambivalence. I guess I'm going to call it ambivalent close. Does that make any sense? But the question now becomes that as this person is getting older, they have said to me, what happens to me when my husband is gone and there's no one, and I am by myself? What happens to me? Who takes care of me? That's an interesting, although somewhat possibly depressing thought.
Mm-hmm.
To be facing that alone, whatever that might be. And
yeah.
And I don't know, does a character in your book ever have any of that kind of thoughts in the book?
She has a young child through most of the book, and she is friends with a couple. The Gracie in the book is her best friend, this woman who becomes her best friend, and she's happily married, and she has a wonderful marriage, wonderful family. She met her husband when she was 14. And the other character, Ruth, that's Gracie. And the other character, Ruth, has, you know, never settled down. She's lived in Europe. She's done many, many interesting things. She's had boyfriends here, there, everywhere. She's never picked that path. And then, lo and behold, what happens to the married sort of settled down person is all kinds of really terrible tragedies strike her family. And first she gets sick, and then she gets better, and then her husband gets sick, and then her husband dies, and all sorts of things happen. And I don't want to tell you what happens in the end, but this woman's husband dies. She's about 50, and she's been with him literally since she was a teenager. And she's faced with that. I mean, the great tragedy of you know, being that young, having young kids, and having to deal with it. So it's I have a friend who lost her husband. She had a husband who was about 5 or 10 years younger than she was, and he died very young. He died in his early 50s of a terrible disease. And so you don't. I mean, all of us are ultimately alone. Really, we have to deal with ourselves and our difficulties and figure out solutions. I mean, no one can really take care of anybody else entirely, and maybe they're not going to be around. So it's, I mean, I just believe in trying as hard as you can to stay as useful as you can. I mean, for me, yoga is extremely important. I was telling someone the other day, I had this crazy time this winter. I fell down my cellar stairs once because I forgot to turn the light on, and I slipped, landed on my back, and I thought, I've really done something bad. And then I moved around a little bit, and then all of a sudden I got up, and I thought, my God, I practically bounced. I didn't, nothing, no bruises, nothing. And then I fell on the ice the following week. I was walking somewhere with my suitcase, and I hit some black ice there on the sidewalk. And both times, and I just got up. I was okay, and I thought, boy, if I didn't do all this agonizing stretching yoga class, I probably would have hurt myself badly.
Mm-hmm.
So, I still could fall and hurt myself badly, but so could anyone.
Sure, sure. Well, there's a certain element of what will be, as we're going through life, either single or married or attached or unattached.
Yeah, I mean, it's true, and it's people are doing different things now. You know, boomers are forming communities, living in the same brownstone building, different apartments, having somebody help with food. I mean, there are lots of. I think this generation of people, particularly Americans, I think we're kind of not going to settle for less than perfect, and we're going to figure it out.
Mm-hmm.
I think not too many of us really want to end up in a convalescent home.
Right.
So.
Right.
Or even a retirement community or an assisted living community. It always seems sad that you're sort of locked into one generation in those places. I think people need to be living with other generations.
Well, the multi-generational thing, I think, is very important because it keeps everybody vibrant. And
mm-hmm.
those that aren't the vibrant ones are the inquisitive ones, and they will develop their vibrancy as they age. It's a pretty interesting way of doing things if you can have an integrated arrangement like that. I know here in this area we have an organization that takes care of seniors, daycare arrangement for seniors that are in need of that kind of an assistance. And what the interaction is with a preschool group.
Oh, I love hearing about this.
That they get together every day and they play games and they read.
Oh, it's so wonderful.
And they whatever. And it's the elderly and the very young, the preschoolers. And it's it's a big, big hit. I mean,
isn't that great?
Really, yeah, it really is. It really is.
That really does sound great. Great for the kids.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Especially if they don't have grandparents near them. I mean, there's that whole grandparent thing. And I've gotten to know this in the last 7 years, this grandparenting thing. And believe me, when the time comes that your son has children, this grandparenting thing is really cool.
Cool. Oh, I know, I'm so jealous. But I had my son when I was practically 40. Actually I was over 40, in fact. And this is one of the perils of this, because who knows, if he waits as long as I did, forget it. Hopefully whoever his girlfriend is or his wife is at the time, she'll say, we have to move this along.
Yeah. Yeah.
At least so I can have that experience, but you know, who knows? You can't control what your kids do.
That's very true. That's very, very true. I was very fortunate. I mean, my daughter met a wonderful guy, and they were married for three or four years. They traveled Europe together. They did all kinds of things like that. They came and settled and decided that they had met their goals that they had planned for themselves, and they wanted to start a family, so they had the family. And to tell their story is, I've never been that organized a day in my life. And they're planning everything from when they have their first baby to, name it, they've probably got it written down somewhere in some sort of a plan. But they get a lot of things accomplished, I tell you that.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. Let's get back to the topic of your book. We're having a great conversation here, and I'm looking at this and I'm saying, my gosh, our time is disappearing. I want to get more into this book. You mentioned, of course, that it is a novel, but it's basically about you. At what point does the novel become the memoir, or the memoir say, I don't want to write the memoir, I want to make it a novel? And how does that, what is that decision process, or does it just kind of evolve?
You know, I wish I could answer that question. I can't even tell you how it happened, because I started out, I am mostly a memoir writer. That's what I like, is the truth and reality. And I started writing it that way. And then all of a sudden, I wanted to have a little more fun. I wanted to make it a little more entertaining. I wanted to cheat a little bit. I wanted to I know you've had the experience, all of us have. You go into a crowded room or a party, and you just had something happen to you. Well, as soon as you're telling the story, you're exaggerating. You just are. You're making the person, if the person was fat, you're making them obese. If the person was mean, you're making them even meaner than they were. You're sort of heightening the whole thing. And that's what it was like. It was like sort of taking a photograph and then taking some pretty colors, you know, black and white photograph, and then deciding, oh, I think I want to have her have red hair instead of just, you know, mousy brown hair. I want to have them go to the Caribbean for a vacation instead of just a weekend, you know, outside of their town. I put in, there's a romantic scene in the book. I won't tell you which one it is, but it never happened. It was an unlikely tryst, an unlikely evening with two characters that actually had the baby together and had been fighting for many, many years since they had the baby together and separated, weren't married. And then somehow their son, the mother takes the son on a ski trip, and the son breaks his arm, and the parents are both in the emergency room with the child, and the child's okay, and they're both so relieved. They bring them back together, and then bam, there they are, you know, on the living room floor after this very, very warlike relationship for so many years. Just sort of ironic. Now, that didn't happen, but I thought, wouldn't it be fun if that happened? And it could have.
It could have.
So that was, I had great fun with that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's like you're not telling lies, but you certainly are embellishing the truth.
You're telling lies. Let's put it out there. I mean, if you're saying that two people ended up in a romantic, you know, love scene, and it never happened that way,
well,
then you're telling a lie, right?
That's another story. I mean, but that could have, maybe it was wishful thinking. Who knows?
yeah. Yeah.
But I mean,
nobody really minds, really.
Well, and that's right. Nobody really cares, because they don't know.
Right.
You know, they don't know if it's true or not. It's like dealing with Congress. You can't. You can never know whether they're lying or not.
Right. It's always fun to have people guess what happened, what was true and what wasn't true.
Exactly.
It's always fun, and no one knows but me. Some of the stuff, I mean, obviously the people in my life know some things that I'm cheating, you know, that I'm changing, but I'm the only one that really knows.
as you were writing this book, and you were putting this this down in your on your computer, and you're going along, I mean, can you would you write? Do you write, and all of a sudden you're getting
you're really into it, and the words come faster and things happen quicker, and you can't get it down fast enough before you lose that
that's what you hope for.
Yeah,
that's the greatest, then you're having the greatest day. It's usually the greatest 20 minutes that you're having, mm-hmm. but it's a great 20 minutes when it happens. You have to do an awful lot of sitting around and, you know, bleeding, as they say, bleeding ink until, you know, but that does happen sometimes. That's kind of the payoff, I guess. That's like hitting a home run or whatever.
Yeah.
I'm not good with baseball metaphors, but.
Well, it's in golf, we call it being in the zone.
In the zone, yes.
In the zone. I mean,
that's right.
When you walk up to the ball, you see the shot, you take your club, you make the shot. The shot's perfect, just what you imagined, and you move to the next one. And there could be all kinds of things going on around you, but it's like a tunnel vision. You're in that zone, and that's what it's like on the golf course, anyhow. And when I've done a little bit of writing, I know my writing comes in spurts. I mean, I was starting to write something. I said, I want to write a book about whatever, just the other day. And I started doing some things, and I started making notes, and I got a couple of Word, in a Word document, I got about 4 pages of notes and just random thoughts.
That's wonderful.
And trying to put it together. And then I went back to it again a couple of days later, and I said, I looked at that, and I said, what the hell was I thinking?
don't do that to yourself. I'm sure there's something in there.
No. I'm sure there is. I know there is.
Yeah.
But I'm saying, how am I gonna organize this? Because I got to get back to some semblance of that to be able to pull what I was doing out of it and put it in a sequential situation where it makes any kind of sense at all. Because, I mean, it was so random. It was just, well, I got to put this in. Oh, I got to put that in. Well, that doesn't come before that. It goes after that. It goes, I don't care. Put it on the paper. And that's kind of the way I do it. I just put it on the paper and then hopefully.
I think that's the most important thing is getting it all down.
Yeah,
and then later on you deal with it.
Yeah,
it's like shooting a film. You know, they leave 9/10 of the film on the cutting room floor. You just shoot a lot of footage. Just shoot this, shoot this, shoot this, and then, okay, maybe the person can come into the room.
Right, right.
And then, you know.
Well, we do that when we go out and we do interviews. We do video interviews for businesses as part of some of the other offshoots of what we do. And we'll go in and we'll shoot. I'll shoot B-roll. It'll be all over the guy's store or his office and people working and that and the other.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and it ends up being a 3-minute piece, and I might have 15 minutes worth of just B-roll on the film. And then we got to go through that and find the appropriate stuff to use. And hopefully you got it. You know, hopefully it's on there somewhere. So. Yeah,
yep.
I know exactly. There's a lot of that that goes on in writing a book. A lot of it goes on in filming. The only place that doesn't go on is when we're live on the radio, because everything we say gets.
That's true.
This is it.
What were you writing about? I'm a writing teacher. So as soon as you say to me you were writing something, I have to know what it was about.
Oh, I was putting together something about putting golf tournaments together. As a guide for successful golf tournaments, or what has to be, what do you have to consider when you're thinking about a golf tournament? And it was from whether you want it to be a very bottom line, very basic golf tournament, or whether you want it to be a high end golf tournament, a fancy club, for big dollar charities, or just for your Rotary club type of thing. So it's
That's great. That's, you know, you have a passion for golf, so your passion will show.
Well, I do. I enjoy it. I wish I could play it more, but back to the book.
Okay, Saving Gracie by Jill Teitelman. It's available on Amazon.
We're still Saving Gracie. Yeah, exactly.
Yep. E-book, paperback.
There you go. All the above forms. Let me ask you this: does Gracie get saved?
Oh, my goodness. You asked the hardest question. Well, if I tell you the truth...
I'll never know.
If I don't tell you the truth, you could know by reading it. Let's just say that in some ways she does get saved and in some ways she doesn't. Let's just say that.
Sure. Okay.
But one
That's
way
fair.
She gets saved is because I wrote a book about her.
Mm-hmm.
So she is saved that way, which is another way to think about it.
one of the interviews questions that I always hear when people are talking about the book, and especially when they're talking about a book that has some autobiographical or memoir portions to it, or some of it is written that way, the question is, well, was it cathartic? did you free yourself of demons or whatever else you may have been carrying around?
I think yes. I think that I can answer absolutely. There is, you know, most people in my experience, maybe because I'm a writer and I talk to a lot of people who want to know about writing, but most people I talk to do want to write a book or have written a book or have written many books. And I think that getting something down that's your own truth about something about the world, or painting it or making a piece of furniture that expresses, you know, who you are is it's cathartic and it's very empowering. It's a wonderful thing to be able to say, this is me, this is my book, this is the cover, this is how I wanted it to look, this is what I wanted to say, these are the people I wanted to thank in the book. You know, you have this wonderful place where you acknowledge people in your life that have helped you. And I think all of that, the process of writing it, the story that you write, how much meaning it has to you, and then just the fact that you're actually getting it all together and actually doing it, because it takes, you know, a huge amount of work to do it, to do it well anyway. I mean, people are throwing up these e-books overnight. Some people are writing 17 books a month, just, you know, I'm going to write a book about blah, blah, blah. I'm not talking about those kind of books. I'm talking about books that you want people to think about and talk about after they've read it.
Mm-hmm.
Which is one of the other great things, is also cathartic, because I actually had I have a great aunt who's in her, she's 97 now, and she read it, and she said to me, I mean, she knew that it was not entirely me, but she knew it was pretty much me, and she's my father's sister, and she said, I never understood you before I read this book. And I looked at her, you know, I said, really? What did you mean? And she always saw the story from my father's point of view. My father and I didn't get along. And this book kind of explains how difficult the relationship was and why. And I finally had my turn, you know. I finally had,
mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, my father wasn't around to defend himself anymore. But, I mean, I wrote about him with love. But she said she never thought about what it was like for me to have that kind of father. She adored him. He was her brother. He was a wonderful, wonderful guy. But, you know, he wasn't always such a great father. And that was hugely cathartic to have my aunt say that.
Sure.
Felt like saying, why didn't you know all that when I was a kid?
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't you defend me a little bit, you know? But
right.
Sooner or later,
yeah,
we get understanding.
Isn't there somebody that wrote a book and the name of the book was My Turn?
My Turn, yes. Yes, yes, yes. I know. It's not coming to mind.
Not coming to me either. But
no. It might be a column title as well.
Maybe.
Yes, it is. That's a good title. Somebody could reuse it.
Yeah.
Yes, I don't know. I'll have to look that up right away.
Yeah.
As we can do now.
Yeah, there you go. It's kind of like the headstone that says, see, I told you I was sick.
yeah.
It's my turn. Well, I'm getting eaten.
Right.
It's my turn.
Right. Right.
So in the process of writing this book, did you have any major periods? I mean, I think any time anybody writes, you have a period of, and we discussed this briefly, for lack of a better word, writer's block. A place where it's just not coming to you as readily as you had hoped, or you don't want to force it, but you kind of sit away. I liken it to that Arlo Guthrie song, sitting around waiting for it to come around on the guitar again, you know, when you've got the guitar licks going on, the guitar solo. So it's just waiting for it to come around on the guitar again. It'll be along shortly. I'm still waiting, you know. I mean, did you have any of those kind of blockages?
You know, I think that one of the hard things about writing is it's so delicate, the process somehow. And if you show it to the wrong person too soon while you're still forming it, If somebody just even makes a funny expression after they read it, that can throw you off for weeks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you really have to protect it. You have to only show early things to just people you really trust. Whenever I taught writing, it was always, you know, we're going to read these essays by students or these stories and say what we like about them, say what's good. Don't say, oh, you didn't do this or your spelling is wrong. Or that can have a huge effect on someone, any artist, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if it were easy to do it, wouldn't it? This book took me 10 years to do. So, I mean, I wasn't writing every day of the whole 10 years, for sure. There were years where I put it away because I tried to get it published a while back and it didn't happen. So, and then I got really disgusted with it. And then I thought, it took me a while to say, well, wait a minute, maybe it's not that, maybe I need to work on it some more. So then I got back to it. You need help, you need readers, you need friends, you need a lot of support, but you have to be very careful who you talk to and who you tell. And, you know, it can be very destructive, very, very destructive to have somebody say just even one negative word prematurely.
Deborah has a couple of things that she says, and one of them has to do with letting people know what you've got going on prematurely, too soon. And it's
mm-hmm.
don't spill your popcorn in the lobby. is one of them. And the other one is the old standby. You know, keep your light. You know, go. Sometimes it's best to keep your light under a bushel basket. So you know, because you don't want people to know exactly what you're going on. You can tease them with a little bit of light coming through the cracks in the basket, but you don't want to uncover that whole doggone thing because
mm-hmm.
it's not ready for prime time yet.
Mm-hmm.
But I particularly
mm-hmm.
like the one about don't spill your popcorn in the lobby, because I'm the kind of guy that says, hey, I'm doing this and da 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 whatever, and then all of a sudden they say, what happened to your deal? I said, oh well, hell. And that's worse than.
Yeah, no, that's an important skill to know who to say what to and when.
Exactly.
You know, the writing process is very difficult, very, very difficult. If it were easy, I mean, there are, I think it's, what is it, three million books published a year, or is it more than that? I think it's something like that.
Now it may be more when you consider all the e-books and all.
Yeah, I don't even think that's including all the e-books, exactly. And so, you know, a lot of people manage to do it, but a lot of those people could have probably done something better if they had gotten some. You need criticism. You need editors. You can't do it alone. You absolutely have to have editors that you trust who have to set you straight and say, I don't want to read three sentences in a row that say the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So you do need editors, absolutely. Find somebody that you really trust who's going to tell you, who's going to be encouraging, but also be very smart. You need that perspective. You need somebody else's eyes on anything that you do, I think, pretty much, because you're just one person. But at the same time, you absolutely can't listen to anybody that you have to. You have your own vision too. So it's a tricky process. You have to know when to listen, when not to listen, when to insist that you're going to do it this way anyway because you just have to. It's like anything else that you do that's creative. I mean, if you're painting colors in your house and somebody comes over and says, "I don't like that color," you know, it's too bad. You're the one who's living in the house.
That's right. Don't come visit me.
Don't come visit me if you don't like the color. Right. Exactly.
Well, it's like whenever I'm writing something, and I don't write that much, but I'm starting to write more. And even if it's a somewhat detailed email that I'm writing to somebody about something that we or a proposal of some sort, I'll write it, I'll edit it, I'll run it through spell check and whatever. And then I'll give it to Deborah and I'll say, here, fix it.
Uh-huh.
I always tell her, fix it. Just make sure.
Oh boy.
Just make sure that it still sounds like me.
Yeah. Right.
She has this innate capability because she's working with several authors, and she has this innate capability to speak in their voice.
Mm-hmm.
And so when she starts editing, she is editing in their voice
mm.
because she has talked to them at length. almost ad nauseum with regard to the flow of what they're trying to accomplish in the book, what their overall structures and beliefs are with regard to what they're writing, and so on. So, and she can be on the phone with for 2 hours, 2.5, 3 hours with somebody talking talking about this project. And when she's done, she's got almost a legal pad full of notes, and she will go through those notes and she will decipher them. And when she turns it around and she gives it back to them with whatever the adjustments are, she goes, "Holy Toledo, it's me. You made it sound like it is me. I know, that's me. That's exactly what I was thinking." She said, "How did you do that?" She says, "I heard what you said. I heard what you said." And that's her secret. So when I say to her, after living with her for 25 years now, I say, "Here, make it sound like me. Fix it and make it sound like me."
Well, you're a lucky person.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
No doubt about it.
Yeah.
And I readily admit it.
Yeah.
What else do we need to know? We're coming down to the short rows, as they say in the farm country.
I love that. Well,
what else
do
we need to know about the book itself and about the story? What else do we need to know
Well, the story is really, I mean, the sort of themes in the story are motherhood, certainly. There are fathers in the book too. It's a little bit more about being a mom than a father, but it's certainly got fathers in it. It's about the choices that we make in our lives. It's about how to be funny when life gets tough. These characters are handed some pretty lousy options, and certainly health-wise. And when everything else is, when the world is really dark, I mean, pretty much all you're left with is your sense of humor. Sometimes you can't even have that. But if you have any way of getting through coping and getting perspective and getting through the day, getting through the hour, whatever it is, it's got to be humor. You're sitting in the hospital waiting room, and you know, you have to find something to laugh about. You look at the ugly wallpaper that they've picked, or the funny expression on somebody's face, or this is a lot of medical stuff in this book because the characters get sick and they deal with cancer and they deal with hospitals and crazy doctors and doctors arguing over what to do. When you hear a bunch of surgeons arguing, saying, not agreeing with each other, but what ought to be done. It's not so much fun sitting there watching them, hearing your surgeons argue. You have no confidence whatsoever. So what can you do? You can just, find a way to laugh about it. You can't really figure out what surgery to do on yourself. I don't think anybody could. And so I think it's really about that. I think it's about laughing, you know, finding ways to be funny and finding ways to find meaning. And it's about friendship. It's about mortality. It's got marriages. It's got late dating. There's a period in Ruth's life where she's now got a young child, but she's left his father. And her friend encourages her to start looking. At that point, it was in the newspaper, at personal ads. And so there's all kinds of crazy experiences that she has doing that, you know, even in her, at that point, she's in her late 40s, actually. And then she does meet someone, and then she does actually end up marrying him. And her parents are thrilled because she's never been married. She gets married at, I think, 51 years old. Her parents are, you know, finally getting to have the party they've always wanted, invite all their friends. And then about 2 years later, she has to tell them, "I'm getting divorced." Telling your parents about the divorce, you know, in her case, it was the hardest thing about the divorce was telling her parents that she had to get divorced.
Sure.
So it's got a lot of real life in it. And I think that the dialogue, I'm told, is drop dead funny. People say that they really do stay up late reading it. They start reading it and they honestly can't put it down. They tell me this. I believe them. I hope I believe them. And it feels great. I've had some, you know, really terrific reviews, and it's a great feeling to put a book out there and have people say they enjoy it so much. It's really wonderful. I encourage everyone to do it.
There you go. Is there a sequel? Is there a sequel on the way?
Well, there is a sequel. It's, as I said, I'm working on a memoir, which will be the sequel, but it'll be a memoir this time. It won't be fiction. So I don't know if anybody's ever done that before, but I'm going to try to pull that off. have a sequel that's real. And who knows, the next one, the one after that may be fiction. I don't know.
Well,
but I'm
going
to try to stick to the truth this time around. Yes. Right, that book is, you know, not ready for prime time yet, but it is about, it's really about midlife dating is really what it's about, a lot.
Right,
so,
right.
They, hopefully it'll be funny.
They have ways to make you talk and tell the truth, Natasha. Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear that there's
you don't have to force me to talk. All you have to do is buy my book, and there it is. It's only $14, or much cheaper for an ebook. So
and they
it's
can
easier,
get it on,
easier than torture.
And they can get it on Amazon and
yes, any bookstore can order it. It's distributed nationally. It's a small press called Freestyle Press, but it is on Amazon. There are a couple of other books with the same title, Saving Gracie, and there I think there are at least two of them, and they seem to be about people rescuing puppies. Puppies named Gracie.
I saw that when I looked it up on Google.
Yeah,
I
so don't
it,
buy the dog book, or buy the dog book if you want, but buy mine too. And I probably ought to read those dog books, see what they're like.
Yeah, I looked it up on the Google machine.
The Google machine.
The Google machine. And there they all were.
Yeah, well,
you.
People like dogs. I don't think there's a dog in my book at all. Oh, yeah, there might be one dog. I think there is a chapter with a dog now that I think about it. Yes. There is a dog in the book for you dog lovers.
Okay.
Have to put the dog in.
They had the perfunctory dog.
Right. Right.
Yeah. Well, Jill, this has been an absolute pleasure talking with you, and I thank you for taking an hour out of your day to come and visit with me.
Thanks so much. I appreciate it. It was lots of fun.
Yeah, and I enjoyed it as well. So
good.
That having been said, I think we'll close it off for today.
Okay.
Let everybody know that the book, again, is called Saving Gracie by Jill Teitelman, and Teitelman is spelled T-E-I-T-E-L-M-A-N, Teitelman. And you can look it up for Saving Gracie. Make sure you get the one not about the dogs.
And my
Google
website
it.
Is, there's a
okay.
website called saving-gracie.com, and you can read some, I've got some blog things up there and some information about me and about the book.
Very good. All great information.
Yeah.
Thank
you so much. It was great.
Yes, I appreciate it. Thank you. Thank you very much, Jill.
Okay.
Take care now.
Bye.
And that was Ms. Jill Teitelman, author of the book Saving Gracie. Interesting read. Fun read. Takes you on all kinds of a whirlwind of emotions. So we hope that people will pick it up and enjoy reading it. That having been said, we want to thank you for being with us today. We'll be back again with more conversation and more guests as the week goes on. We hope you'll look us up and join us at that time. blogtalkradio.com/boomerandbabe. Love to have you back, and we'll talk to you again real soon. Have a great day, everybody. Take care.
From their studio.